Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. About 140 people gathered at the Lions Center on November 7th for a town hall organized by the Cobourg Police. For nearly 2 hours, residents listened and fired questions to Chief Paul Vandegraaff. The concern in people's voices was evident as the exchanges took place. On today's show, the chief will face another volley of questions following up on the themes raised at the public meeting. The interview digs deeper below the rhetoric to explore underneath the statistics, plans, and promises to search for the proposed solution at this critical time. I'd like to welcome back the Cobourg Police Chief Paul Vandegraaff.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
The Cobourg Police recently held a community meeting at the Lions Center. I'd like to go over some of the talking points and questions asked. Could you start with what is the current status of the encampment?
Again, Robert, the encampment is something that we've been working with for over the last 15 months. And over the last few months, we've seen a steady decrease in the amount of people actually, if we want to call it, residing there. At the time of the meeting, so last week, it was about 3 people who are residing in the encampment. And that's kind of where we're sitting. If it won't be any more than that, could be less than that as we stand today. It's definitely diminishing in its residency, if you will. And that's probably tied to 310 division, the warming room being open, and some of the work that a variety of agencies have done to move people onwards to a variety of forms of care.
Do you not get a regular update then on the status of the encampment? How do you keep track of what's going on there?
Yeah, the great thing about it is we have our team, the HART and MHART, both teams that work in the community around ensuring people that have intersects with police that are suffering mental health conditions. So we get regular updates as it goes. But as far as the amount of people who actually live there, it's difficult. If one were to drive by and you were to count all those tents, you would say it's a lot more. So it's a bit of a moving target to really nail down. But what we felt as of last week, there are about 3 people still kind of regularly residences there.
Now, you mentioned earlier about some new services have opened up as the warming room from the county, but also people have moved into other areas. Do you track those people and where they go?
We don't necessarily track the people, but we tend to bump into them, right? So as our team was through the encampment, they're working with the county and social service providers. So they know who they are, and everybody will be aware of a thing called the by name list. And that's the list of people who are homeless in our county receiving care or resources by social services. So we kind of know who they are. And being a little bit progressive, our team was going through the encampment regularly and saying, like, the end is near. We don't exactly know when, but the end is near, and let's get a plan. And some people took advantage of that and actually got into the line with the county to get placed, or maybe through transition house or into the motel program. So that's kind of what's, I think, by a voluntary method, we've gotten a little bit better than what was originally one time 50 people there.
Do you know if any people have moved from the encampment to other locations in public or government-owned spaces?
I wouldn't know exactly one person, but I can guarantee you some people have moved into transition house and or are staying at the warming room as well. A lot of people, and we've seen this for years, this is pre-encampment, is that some people will live with others, but the good graces of people who have a home. And so we have encountered a couple of residences in town where we've seen some people kind of landed to call that their new home for now.
But what about public spaces? Are you
tracking
that kind of things?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about people who move in, we have seen a variety of small encampments, if you will, but it's basically a tent in a public park or in a private park. We regularly get phoned on those, and luckily our partnership with the town bylaw, they lead on all public space, camping and tenting. And then when we determine it to be private property, then we work with the property owner. And the property owner then sometimes wouldn't even know that in the deep recesses of their property, maybe a tent has been set up. So we're going to continue to do this. This is not new. This has been going on for many years in multiple municipalities.
I'd like to talk about the public meeting that you held. Why did you feel the need to hold a public meeting on November 7th?
We regularly hold these. So this is our third, I will say, larger structured. I've had a couple of smaller ones that are very neighborhood specific. And really what it is for us is when or if we try to time these at or near a circumstance that maybe gets people's interest up. We just hadn't had one this year for a variety of reasons. And November 7th kind of hit as a date that worked with a bunch of other calendars and schedules. And it was, again, something that our community wanted to see, wanted to hear. And that's why we had about 140 people out.
Were you under any pressure to have that meeting?
None whatsoever. I create the pressure on this space. So I really talked to my team about creating opportunities to have meetings like in this nature. I'm very, very pro town hall. I'm very, very pro keeping it simple. In fact, we made this even simpler in the sense that I didn't necessarily go through the standard PowerPoints. It was just more of a speech about really where policing has landed over the last few years and what this 15 months has looked like.
But the timing seemed rather coincidental that we were so close to the turnover of the property, the encampment was going to be moved, the future was looking a bit uncertain around that. Is that just coincidence or was that strategic?
To this very day, I don't know when the property is going to close, so it was coincidental.
In your remarks, you used the word tough a lot. Why do you feel that was necessary? You talked about being tough on this and tough on that. Why did you use that word so frequently?
So the great thing about having these public meetings is these are really assimilations of many private meetings that I have. So as everybody is aware, I meet anybody anytime for any coffee, preferably is my beverage of choice, to talk about what's happening at our board meetings. We have, luckily now, we have some interested parties who come out. And they're all looking for the chief to be different, is the word I used to start. And they wanted a tougher approach. Really what I thought they were wanting and reason my remarks, I balanced a tough on crime, which is an old saying, approach to ensuring that we're doing what it is we are core function and a responsibility of law enforcement and partnered with empathy in how we manage it. So, I've been hearing from a lot of different people that they need higher arrests on this, a different approach. But when you really look at what the last 15 months have left or kind of experienced here in Coburg, it's not necessarily about tough on crime. It's more of the police need to focus on what our lane is and what our lane is typically supposed to be. And again, another word I use was oftentimes our people's time is diluted in carrying others' core responsibilities. So the call really was, yes, we can be tougher in our law enforcement lane when other social agencies or other partners pick up leadership roles in theirs.
You called on the community to move forward with a shared set of values, to be safe, respected, and valued. Can you elaborate on what you meant by those three things?
Sure. When we talk about a safe community, it's our shared responsibility. One, it should be our core value of ensuring that everything we do is recognizing that we're moving towards to be safe and that we value the opinions of our community. Some people see the town hall meetings as an us versus them. And by using that language, it was really me trying to return to those grassroots of community policing where we are the police, the public is the police and the police are the public, really trying to find that foundational space that it is not an us versus them, it's an us. And I really wanted the community to create lanes, and recognizing our team needed to be better in some areas. And we're recognizing and accepting that. And that is a commitment to our values and our values of being a collaborative law enforcement tool for our community.
If we do this, you feel we're going to create a safe and more vibrant community. How does that work? I mean, this is flowery language, but when it comes to getting down to the nuts and bolts, how does it work from both sides, the community side and the police side?
Yeah, so from the police side, it works by us being more visible in our place. And what that means is in that law enforcement lane, and that's what we heard, is they wanted officers to be more visible, more approachable. What it means from the community side is that you need to have faith in the police and that what we're doing is what our core responsibilities are, and truly understanding. And I gave an example where the community were critical of what we were truly doing. But when I outlined to that individual who I got permission to use the example, he was very upset that we didn't attend speedily to an individual who dropped a drug paraphernalia pipe and it smashed. But at that time, there were three other significant calls for service involving police that were truly core functions of police. But the expectation of the community was we would respond to that broken crack pipe right away. So what I need to know is that the community needs to understand that there are other folks who lead in the space of harm reduction and needle pickup, where our space is really focused on what that is, and truly recognizing that the police need to be better in our true lane, but these other lanes that we're kind of asked to lead in after hours, which really isn't our function, needs to be led by others.
That may be true, but from an everyday citizen's point of view, we only know one number to call. And, you know, when you talk about which lane, that expects a lot from a community to know, you know, do I phone mental health? Do I phone this? Do I phone bylaw enforcement? Do I phone the works department? Who do I call? How do you get around that then? What steps do you have to take so that people know what to do, and therefore you get to do your lane and other groups get to do their lane?
Education, education, and more education. And it starts with, for instance, this weekend, we received a call to manage, at very worst case scenario, a trespass to property, when in fact, it shouldn't have been us at all. So we quickly positioned our communication center to stop that, say, yeah, you know what, the police, that's not for us, that's for someone else to manage, and gave them the inference. And then what I did is followed that up this morning, connecting our operational staff sergeant with that team, so we understand, because that came from an organization, it didn't come from an individual. I would like to give you the examples, but I don't have permission to use them. But here's a great example where it's going to take time, but that's where the patience pays off, and us just really reinforcing that. And we're going to continue to push this message through our communications every 2 to 3 weeks, and with real tangible examples about where we're great, where we'll help, and where we'll assist others.
You spent time talking about the encampment. You talked about an approach, and you repeated it several times, about taking care of people that were unsheltered on the former Brookside property. Can you explain how you were approaching the devolution of the encampment as people moved on?
Sure. I mentioned very briefly. So recognizing that these are people, and this is where empathy comes with that tough on crime approach. So recognizing at a date in the future, which we still don't know, is truly the day that the new owner will take over and exact some sort of new direction. Our team had been working with them, going into the encampment, talking to the various individuals in the encampment to say, like, listen, this is literally the line was, the end is near in the sense of living here. Where is it that you want to be? And if you want to start accessing resources, you might be ahead of the line getting into space, be it any of the variety of housing opportunities that exist through the county. So that's how we continue to work with them. We also, we looked at other opportunities where people who may be more of the criminal element versus the homeless element that are circling around the encampment. And we did a variety of law enforcement consent or centric approaches, be it bail and or probation and or warrant applications. So we did a bit of that at the same time. But really, this was just talking to the people. To your point earlier, we generally know who the same people are. And it was really just through volunteerism, such as when we had the first encampment that this town really saw was at the West Beach. We were able to dismantle that encampment without much to do. And then they went up to the county property and then it was dismantled again without much to do. And that's just with good people, the right people, connecting to resources and being that law enforcement presence.
You are asked what you as the chief of police will do to ensure that this does not happen again. Can you share your answer?
Yeah, if we were guilty of anything, and I said this at the meeting, if we were guilty of anything 15 months ago, it was probably not moving or pivoting, and I hate the word pivot anymore, but pivoting quick enough to understand the true scope of what this could have become. My commitment to the group was when we see any encampments setting up on public or private property, that we will ensure the right individuals are engaged with them right away. Private property is quite easy. Private property, the quote unquote Waterloo decision doesn't apply based on our legal opinion. So we'll work with private property owners. And I can tell you, we had one instance this summer where a person had private property. We were identified as there an encampment being present. And that private property owner was not concerned. He was not concerned. He said, I'm fine if they're there for a bit. And then the person, through a mutual respect, went on their merry way. Where it's public property, we're going to work with the town. The town has a far better understanding now of how to move far more quicker. Not that I want to point blame to the town, but we all learn through this. So my job as a chief is we're going to live in the law enforcement reign. We're going to work with bylaw for public property. We're going to work with property owners to make sure they understand what their rights are, what their responsibilities are, what liability they're accepting, and to make sure we're now with 310 Division being open, with that warming room being open 24/7, which is something we haven't seen in this community, we now have a direction to point the right people in the right direction to.
You talked about being more proactive and less reactive. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, we were in a space over the last couple of years with staffing and different things of that nature where we really didn't have an opportunity to, the easiest example is to be proactive in the schools. To be proactive in talking to people, like go back to that education piece where we had that capacity level where our people were just going from call to call to call. And that was both in our numbers, and the last 2 years, the board has seen fit to give me a bit more money to hire more officers, which is awesome, which is great because it's going to help us build that capacity. But also having our capacity diluted, doing everything, being all things to all people. Now that we're nailing this down into space, I would like nothing more than to have a school response officer, because we're very fortunate in Coburg, where in other communities across the country, certain boards don't want uniformed officers in our schools. Our schools want us in the schools. And like, if I think back to Gummo and Murrin Greer and CCI, with that encampment being so close, if I had a school response officer, that person would have been the go-to person to kind of calm the community about what's true, what's not true, what's myth. And that's being proactive. That's getting our officers the opportunity to do a street crime project, to have three officers assigned to a quote on what we call a plainclothes detail to focus on trespass at night, stealing from cars. But unfortunately, we've been very reactive in that we were waiting for the calls to come. And it also speaks to already at the town hall meeting, we had already served November 7th, we had already well surpassed our calls for service from the year prior and the year prior to that. So it's a big combination of those things.
Is it realistic to place so much blame for the encampment and what took place at the feet of the police?
If you ask me, no, it's not fair at all. And I did say that. I will take ownership for maybe my service and our team didn't pivot or didn't transition quick enough. But I can't apologize for the socioeconomic crisis that's struck the country, being poverty, homelessness, and addictions, the addiction-related issues. I can't apologize, nor can I take responsibility for that. But to your point, Rob, as you said earlier, some people don't know where else to go or what else or who else to blame. And it's easiest to call or to call out the service, the only service with the exception of fire and EMS that still answer the phone 24/7, 365.
In the past, you've taken steps on John Street, Division Street, and Battelle Court. How do you police this kind of activity, and what's being done to stop this activity in the town?
Yeah, so those homes, like these individual residences, they come to mind, come to the neighborhoods, become very upset based on all of the things that are obvious to us. And what we do is we increase our patrols. We start to make sure that the uniform presence is there. We enable our mobility of our CCTV network, which is one of our real advantages. We use undercover operations, but most importantly, and that's where in these homes, this is where I say sometimes the greatest power sits outside of the police service. When you look at these homes and what these homes become, yes, it's very easy to say it's a drug den. And as I've said many times, it's not as easy as watching TV to see how these warrants happen and everybody storms in and all these drugs are located. It's a very laborious process to get a search warrant if you're successful, and that's for the right reasons. However, when you look at property standards, when you look at fire safety provisions, and when you look at community expectations, thereby you can see when social services are engaged with people, when property standards lead in their lane, when fire leads in their lane, and the police lead in their lane collectively, that is how 351 John, 821 Battelle, Major Street, that's how those were successful. Not because of the police, not because, but of that concerted effort of everyone coming together from the element of safety, however that's defined by that agency.
At the meeting, Neighborhood Watch was suggested. Why are we not seeing this kind of program in Coburg?
Yeah, so Neighborhood Watch, it was a great question. And it was obviously somebody who's been around communities as long as I have. And as I said, Neighborhood Watch was a wonderful program when it was envisioned back in the probably late 70s, early 80s. And that's the 20th century for those listening in the 1900s. However, with changing demographics in communities where we have two parent incomes, where both parents are out of the house working, and sometimes neighborhoods are more transient, people are less likely to share their personal information. And it's more been taken over by Facebook accounts, neighborhood Facebook accounts and of the like. So Neighborhood Watch is something that can be re-envisioned, but that's where the community steps in. The Neighborhood Watch back in the early days was never started by the police. It was started by the community. The police supported it by providing signs, by providing information, maybe going to the odd meeting of neighbors. But current trends with social media, we would be part of a multitude of different Facebook accounts.
So if somebody's interested in doing this kind of work, how do they get it started? How do they get going?
Actually, the best way to do it with us is our new Community Safety Advisory Council, which meets the final Wednesday of every month, and just meeting with them after the meeting, because they kind of were our co-host of the town hall meeting. They're going to start moving that around the community next year in 2025. So you're going to see them advertise meeting at the library, meeting at the CCI, meeting at the CCC, and different points in between. And those neighborhood watches are best to start in that group of community folk. Those people are there to advise me of what they're hearing at the grassroots. But in lieu of that, again, we'd be more than happy to connect with me, and we'd make sure the right things are happening.
When it comes to drug enforcement, you pledge to work hard, but you also ask the community to be patient. Why do residents need to be patient when they can see the evidence of drug dealing and drug use so prevalent in the community?
Yeah, just seeing somebody what they envisioned to be a quote unquote handoff, or I saw so and so giving such and such to somebody, and that was a drug deal. That's probably not wrong, and I won't argue, and never do I argue with the people. But to take that information, to connect all of those information sources enough to get a real-time information to enable the investigators to get a search warrant from a justice of the peace or a judge. It's not as easy as just that. I saw a deal yesterday afternoon, thereby Paul must be a drug dealer, therefore get a warrant to go raid his house. We're lucky we live in a country where there is a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and there our houses are protected. And as such, our officers not only enforce the law, they have to obey the law. So these things do take time sometimes, and we did hear that I had to call 9 times. That is unfortunate. That should never have happened. But when it comes time to some people think that I've called 3 times, they're dealing drugs at 123 any street. How come you're not raiding 123 any street on the third call? It takes time for our team to put the work together to actually do it legally, because it's as important to arrest somebody, it's as important to convict somebody. And we want to make sure that when we put people before the court, that we can say that there is a case that's going to see right through to conviction.
All that makes lots of sense when you're talking about it. But if you're that person living in that neighborhood and you're seeing these things go down around you, you can empathize with the fact that it creates a lot of fear. Let's be honest. It creates a lot of anxiety. People want to feel safe in their homes. And yet you're talking to us about processes that take time and we've got to be patient. And meanwhile, we're afraid. How do we make those two things fit together so that people can start to see and feel safer and not have to wait weeks and months while you get your crime unit to do an investigation and to bring charges? I mean, this is the reality of it.
Yeah, and that's the disconnect, that we may not ever get to an agreed upon middle. What I can say is we can flood an area with uniform presence, and we've done that before. That is met with varying success. However, if you're hoping at obtaining a search warrant, you need some of that quote unquote covert work or that surveillance work. So at the end of the day, I totally empathize and I agree. And I've lived in communities in my life where I am that neighborhood person who's saying, yeah, but. So we need to be better in listening to our people and communicating better to the community when they call us and report this. And that's where we need to pick up our game a little bit. And when we get that complaint, we need to have that one-on-one conversation with people so that they understand. And again, it shouldn't take months. Like that's not what I'm asking. That's not the level of patience I'm asking for. And what we need to be better at is if we feel that the opportunity of obtaining search warrants are slim to none, then we need to move quicker to another solution, which is, again, what we've seen success in being use of our CCTV camera, increased police presence, special constable presence, and auxiliary presence.
In your remarks, you lay some of the responsibility, and even in our conversation, you've laid some of the responsibility for dealing with certain crimes at the feet of social services, which is a county responsibility, and with the justice system. And you've been saying this for a long time. It's not the first time, and we've talked about it even in our conversations. When are we going to see a change? Where is the collaboration, and where are the solutions so that the finger pointing can stop?
I started the solution conversation by saying that my folks are going to focus on their core function, and we're going to ask and drop the gauntlet up for others, if you will, I hate the term, to pick it up. Now, again, good example, 310 Division Open. This is the first time since this has become a crisis post-COVID where we see a warming room which doesn't exit high acuity people just because it's 6 o'clock in the morning. So my hat's off to all of the drama that sits around 310 Division. My hat's off to the group who put that together to say, we are open 24/7. So now the excuse of, well, I have nowhere else to go at 8 o'clock in the morning is gone. So you will not be able to loiter on the streets. You will not be able to cause havoc for others wanting to use public spaces, because there is an opportunity for someone to go back to the warming room, obey by basic rules, stay warm, stay dry, stay in the area of resources. Having that wraparound service should be the beginning of their change in space. My change in space began November 7th. I am not the leaders of those organizations, and I cannot speak for them. I'm saying to you that we work collaboratively with everyone. And now the call to the duty, if you will, is I expect you to meet me in our space, because no longer are we going to necessarily be the primary response for a found needle in the park. If nobody else can go, obviously my team are going to do that. Why? Because they care. And of course, they're going to do that without even being asked to do that. But at the end of the day, needles in parks, needles in streets, people aimlessly wandering the street where nowhere to go or getting access to resources. We need other people to start leading in that space.
In the meeting, you talked about St. Thomas and their unique program of using special constables. You also mentioned a community first program in Peterborough. What are these and how do they fit into your overall vision for dealing with the concerns that were raised at the community meeting?
Yeah, so what we heard very loud and clear is that there's a cry for increased visibility. There's a cry to put a stop to that, people loitering in vestibules, the sitting on streets, the passed out laying on streets. And so sometimes you can become very insular and self-focused. So as a strategic organization, we look outside and we say, okay, where have we seen it? And it was at a county presentation that I actually heard of the St. Thomas program. And I'm aware of this big proximity of what Peterborough is doing. So St. Thomas has special constables who work very collaboratively with their shelter in St. Thomas. But what they do, they're the first sort of boots on the ground in the main streets of St. Thomas in the morning to make sure anybody who's kind of on the street before businesses come to go, that they get them, get people up, get them moving, and get them moving back towards the shelter or back to the shelter. Maybe it's not even back to it. And then the Community First initiative in Peterborough is really redirecting resources on purpose to focus on the low, low priority minor thefts, minor damages, minor nuisances, which oftentimes we overlook in the space of chasing the more higher end or higher crisis calls. So credit to Chief Betts and the team in Peterborough for actually seeing that there is a real movement to address the concerns of the community by identifying officers, in their case, to do this kind of work. So what I committed to is looking at how those two programs could come, whatever we call it here in Coburg, because we don't have the exact same circumstances, but we have similar events that we can, I don't like cookie cutters, so we can make it. So I've already started to have a few internal meetings about how we would come up with our own response.
During the community meeting, you can hear the concern in people's voices. You can hear their worries, and there's lots of emotions that are running high. When you talk, it's practical. You talk about crime stats. You talk about institutional rules and limits, functions, roles, and plans. Now, while these are facts, these don't necessarily address emotions people are feeling. How do you address the heartfelt feelings people have beyond the facts and figures to help strengthen the community's trust and the police force's credibility to allay fears that are appearing to be driving so much of the discourse right now?
You listen. It starts with having that courage to listen and go back to where we began this interview, Rob. It's the town hall. People ask me, why would you do that? Why it's important? It's important to be heard. We had about 140 people there. We know our community is 22,000. That group of people had a issue they wanted me to hear. That's great. And we heard and we listened and we're empathetic to it. And I would say, and I have said over time on this radio station, that is it a perception of fear? And is it, and I use my wife in that she used to work in the branch downtown. And at first I would say, are you afraid? And she says, nah, she would go with unnerved instead of afraid. And then as things progressed before she retired, it was no longer unnerving. It was actually scary at times in walking out this time of day where the branch closes and you're walking through the darkness back to the behind the stores to the car where the cars are parked. So I myself have had to change some of the language. So I empathize, I listen, I agree with, I don't argue, I don't debate. I just hear, to your point, I respond with practicalities, but we will continue to listen. We will continue to strive to be better. We will create opportunities where when we've dropped the ball and we've not served as well as we could, we'll own that. But really what it means is not about saying, that's why I promised nothing other than we're going to be better. I didn't promise this brand new program is going to fix all your ills. No, I've listened to what you've had to said. We've heard some ideas. We're trying to come up with what's the best thing. At the end of the day, I really truly believe that some people will be afraid, some people will be angry. And my job is just to listen. And if we can steer them away from that, great. And if we can, as long as we're open and sharing, we should be better for it tomorrow.
Chief Van de Graaff, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Coburg Police Chief Paul Van de Graaff. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.